Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, it was only a few months ago when we featured Mac Little for the first time with Daughters of Hades, specifically January 27th of this year, 2023. And she created such an impression with respect to that, we had to invite her back pretty soon afterwards. And we're delighted to be able to welcome her back to the program today. Also to talk about not Daughters of Hades, but Shelter in a Hostile World. Mac Little, welcome back to the Author of the Week feature. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Excellent. For having me.
And are you still actually writing with the soundtrack to Black Sails, or indeed watching Outlander to actually inspire your writing?
Yes, I just finished going through the entire series of Outlander. Now I'm just looking for some more period pieces to play in the background.
Excellent. Now, we had a fascinating discussion on your debut, obviously, about your time as a military police officer, working with respect to crisis in the former Yugoslavia and so on. And we talked, obviously, about the diaspora and the way in which you'd address very effectively the whole essence of Daughters of Hades and this connection with the Caribbean and areas with respect to that. Moving on, obviously, to Shelter in a Hostile World. This again described as a steely-eyed historical novel following one man's difficult life in Igboland and Barbados. And I suspect most people were aware that Igboland is currently part of modern-day Nigeria. So talk us through your thoughts on this story of Badu, please.
Right. So Badu is an enslaved man, and my purpose, my goal in writing this was to show that his humanity and his identity before he became enslaved, and that, you know, when you talk about slavery and the people that are in the grips of it, you don't really see them as human beings or their rich history before they came to the New World. So what I did was I detailed Badu's journey as a 15-year-old that led him to enslavement in Barbados. And at the same time, it's a dual timeline. So at the same time, we follow Badu as he escapes Barbados after he incited a slave revolt. Mm. And parts of his life play off of each other as he, you know, finally finds redemption.
Yeah. It's certainly a powerful opening. I mean, you have the introduction with Badu tying a witch to a tree as punishment for the atrocities she's facilitated. And again, those atrocities involving basically children being handed over to sex trafficking and death rising up to arrange themselves in the form of duppies or ghosts. So you've got the horror aspect in that from that sort of point of view. Is that because it's synthesizing both your love of horror and historical fiction in one sort of coalescence?
Absolutely. And also it's it was a way for me to explore the Caribbean lore and lore from Africa about supernatural beings and their spirituality. So it was a great opportunity to bring all of my interests in together for and exploring the spirituality that I haven't been able to get in touch with, you know, as an American. And as I researched Duppies, I realized that some of the things in my childhood correlated to that, and I didn't know it was the same thing. So it was a wonderful learning experience for me, and I hope it will be for my audience.
Well, I know that back in January, when we spoke about Daughters of Hades, still available, of course, Jessica Burtis was with us. She was then in Dublin, actually, as opposed to being back in North Carolina. She's now back in North Carolina now. So, Jessica, any follow-up questions for Mac that you'd like to raise about her latest text, not so much Daughters of Hades, but this one we're discussing, which is Shelter in a Hostile World?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have so many questions that I could ask and that I wanted the answer to. But if for one, picking one for right now, I would love to know about your research process since you were talking about all the folklore that you look into and the history of it.
My research process is not organized. As a plot, when I develop my plot, I'm a pantser. I have a general idea of where I want the story to go. So I go scene by scene. And so I outline my scene a little bit. And as I write it longhand and I write what I want to happen. And then when I come and type it up, I'll do the research to, make it coalesce and shaped into more of a narrative. So basically, I research as I go along. So I do some preliminary research when I'm creating the story to see what's going on around the world and in that particular locality for the time period. And sometimes I have to do research to decide the time period and the locations and what group I'm going to be speaking about. But once I nail that down, then I just research as I go.
And how do you go about getting to know your characters and building who they are?
Character sheets. I create a character sheet for all of my characters, even the minor ones. And that basically writes the story for me. So research goes into that too. So where was my character born? What was it like growing up in that area? I have to research, what it was like for them growing up in a particular period or area. So yeah, that's my story is a character driven, I think. And so once I have the character's history written down, I can just link it all together and put it into a narrative.
Character sheets are great.
They are wonderful.
I'm intrigued that you share the same astrological sign, I believe, as Jessica. Obviously, is this a thing, Cancer? Are you also, I mean, from that sort of point of view, is that also something that you kind of also connect with when you're doing your writing, Jess?
Oh, I feel like Cancers must be creative, you know? Maybe it's something about the moon. It's so mystical and mysterious. It helps us.
Certainly opens that whole thing up. So, since we spoke in January, Mac, how's life been treating your good self? I mean, has it been a case of no? I've been completely fingers to the bone dealing with the latest novel, or have you taken time out and so on?
I have been taking a couple of breaks. I celebrated my 29th anniversary with my husband in June. So we went to Honduras to celebrate. And I had hoped to get in a little research there and interview people, but I just laid on the beach and drank and smoked. It was
How
wonderful.
was the food in Honduras?
Oh, it was great. It was very delicious, spicy. It was good. And the interesting thing about Honduras is they have a population there called the Garifuna, and they are like African and Indian mixed, and they come from the Saint Vincent and Grenadine Isles. And when the British were trying to take over St. Vincent, they caused such a problem for them to take over the islands that when the British finally did conquer them, they were exiled. And they went to Honduras and they ended up in Honduras and Roatán. So I was interested in talking to them and finding out about the history. So,
That's so interesting.
You shared with us, obviously, the importance of the Duppies and, of course, the mysticism of the Caribbean lore of the Duppy, etc. Would you like to talk a bit about the mystical Kapok and this tree-based thing that does that also feature in your latest work?
The kapok, the witch is tied to a kapok tree, and they have the kapok has very tall roots that are above the ground, and in the corners of these roots near the trunk is where the death beings live, and it's their portal into the world. The kapok is a mystical tree. I think the roots of it has to do with it's a sinister, it has sinister roots, and it has a sinister connotation with the African descendants in the Caribbean, because slaves were hung from the tree, and a lot of, there was a lot of bad things associated with the kapok tree. So it's the mystical element in Caribbean lore.
Now, we appreciate there's a writer's strike going on at Hollywood at present, so there's a bit of a delay in various other aspects within that. But let's talk about another little blog entry that you put together, which refers to television adaptations with built-in fan bases are a double-edged sword. So again, this whole notion of we know escapism is universal and so on. But is this a case of sometimes fans effectively try to they take ownership in a way which effectively sort of means that they're doing more harm than good to the characters they're actually looking at?
I believe that's true. And also, I think that I've discussed this a lot with on panels, and I think that fans have an unrealistic expectation because they don't know how production of a movie or a television series is created or translated from a book. And you can't put everything that's in the book into a movie, and basically the movie is an adaptation. It has to be condensed, and it has to be altered, and in a lot of cases it has to be updated to the current norms and demographics of society. And a lot of people
Certainly, I think the flak that the Disney Corporation are actually experiencing with respect to some of their latest incarnations and reviews is probably tantamount to that. Why worry about, remaking Snow White? Why not make a completely original tale, perhaps, would be a better line forward.
Yeah, I have no problem with them, updating the characters to reflect their audiences. But I think it would have an easier time if they adapted material that was already diverse. And I think it would be a lot more interesting. And people can keep their sacred cows and love their books and imagine their characters any way they want to, and they can just pull from different resources, newer resources. And yeah, I think we spend a lot of time looking, or I think Hollywood spends a lot of time looking backwards and trying to refurbish what worked in the past. But I think they should take some chances and create new traditions.
I think you'll certainly find that's something which, again, is echoed by a whole range of elements within that. Anyway, Jessica, any thoughts from yourself?
I'd love to know what some of the projects that you're working on and might be upcoming are.
Well, all I do is work on this series, basically. So I finished the second. The novella is kind of like of a Shelter in a Hostile World is a bit of a spin-off, and some connective tissue to book two and My Love and Peace series. So Fortune's Revenge is the working title for book two, the sequel to Daughter of Hades. And it's completed. It's with the editors, and I'm really excited about getting that out. And it's also with beta readers right now too. And right now I'm working on the third book in the series, but it's more of a prequel. And we see how Captain Duff and Captain Ford become Buccaneer pirates, and we look at the life of an African queen. I call it Adelola, and she's kind of like an amalgamation of the queens I've read about in Africa, Nzinga, and another Ashanti queen who defended the Golden Stool. Yeah, I can't remember her name right now, but it's like an amalgamation how she fought the slavers and ended up becoming a slave herself. So yeah, that's what I'm working on now. It's kind of traumatic, traumatizing writing it, but I think it's an exciting story. I'm really eager to get out.
And you said that you kind of you're a pantser. So had you had this book in mind and planned, or did the story kind of organically take you there?
It organically took me there. I think my work is misunderstood. A lot of reviewers and I appreciate the awards that I get. They focus on slavery and the oppression, but that's not what my book is about. It's about overcoming that and subverting the system. And so I was reluctant to write about life on the slave ship because to me it was traumatizing to write about. And I thought I could give it an uplifting spin by, have it culminate in a revolt. But writing about the conditions leading up to the revolt was difficult to write about. And I hadn't intended to make that, to put that in the book, but as I was writing it, that's just how it happened. So.
Do your characters speak to you? Do you actually engage in conversation with them? A lot of authors say that they are so real. I mean, you say about not putting them through trauma, etc. Is that something where you kind of think, what are you doing to me?
Well, they don't question me. But I do hear them in conversation. I can hear them talking to each other, and they reveal themselves to me. So it feels kind of psychotic, but to me it's comforting to hear their voices. If I didn't hear their voices, I think I would become untethered and just, go away.
So it's kind of creative psychosis then.
Absolutely.
Okay. You mentioned you're a big fan of Colleen McCulloch. Is that still the case several months down the line? Thornbird still number one, or are there any other authors who've stepped into Colleen McCulloch's lines as in terms of your own love of other writers?
Well, I've been revisiting since his death. I've been revisiting Cormac McCarthy, and he is masterful. He is a masterful writer, and he teaches me so much about description and horror. So his stories are, it's like beautiful destruction. It's horrifying and beautiful at the same time. And I would love to be able to capture, his ability to do that in my writing.
Well, the road is always a good way to actually explore the whole notion of where we're going and what we're doing from that point of view. Okay, Jessica, back to you.
I think it makes a lot of sense that you mentioned that your books have so much subversion in them since you're a big fan of horror. And it seems that one of the hallmarks of horror is that subversion and how it kind of things happen that you don't quite expect.
I like going to places that scare me. And I think I don't know where that comes from. I guess it always excited me as a child to be scared or to have some adventure or something thrilling happen to me. So yeah, horror is It's hard to, I, it's something I don't, I haven't really examined deeply about my love of horror. I just know that it's always been with me, even from the Bible stories my mom read to me. I thought they were horrifying. And, as kids who would make up things like going back to the duckies, we would, I remember one Halloween and we were at our church. And our church has a graveyard, on its grounds. And so during the Halloween, my friends and I were running through the graveyard, scaring each other. And they told us that Low Booty was going to come get us. Low, Low Booty. He is, when you look at it, when you look at his correlations, he would be a duppy that we were running from, and that was like a part of our culture and our play. So yeah, horror was play for me, I guess. It was fun.
And it
Something
certainly has
comforting.
served as a key narrative trope for everything from, as Jessica and myself looked at, the Live and Let Die and Baron Samedi voodoo movements and onwards, really. You've got that interconnection that works within the whole side of things.
Right. And also the spirituality has been discounted and downplayed, but there's something universal about African spirituality that you see in lots of other cultures, and it's not just superstition and it's not scary voodoo or anything like that. It's what's the word?
An
Pantheist,
archetype,
huh?
perhaps? An archetype? A cultural
Are
archetype?
pantheistic. You find spirituality in everything, in nature, in fellow human beings, and in spirits. I think it's been discounted for far too long, and I think it needs to be revisited as a spirit of spirituality.
Just returning to Shelter in a Hostile World, and indeed Daughter of Hades, I know we've talked about, adaptations and media and various other bits and pieces. Do you have any particular actors or folk who you'd particularly like to perform as any of your lead characters? Any sort of dream cast that you have in mind?
When I write, I call the internet for pictures that look like my characters, but I don't know any of their names. They're just models or people that posted their pictures to the internet. So right now, I have a lot of there are not a lot of people, persons of color to choose from. So I would be interested to see someone new. I would like for this to be an opportunity for some up and coming actor to cut their teeth on.
Okay. And
But
how about audiobooks? Because obviously they're extremely popular. Are they already available in audio format, or is that something again that you're keen to develop?
I am keen to develop it, and it's coming down the road. My publisher is, making moves to get that done. And I'm hoping that we can find a voice actor that can do accents, because I have a lot of different languages working here in my books.
So a kind of classic line, if you could actually go back 30 odd years and tell the younger Mac Little at the end of the 90s, what advice would you actually give to yourself back in the day?
Don't stop writing. I was discouraged once I graduated college. I couldn't finish anything. And I learned now that all I need to do is just sit down and write, and it'll come together eventually. Just don't stop writing. Just do it. And don't have any kind of what do you call it, insecurities about it. Just do it.
That's right. Literary festivals, of course, are back with us. We're in the post-pandemic age, at least for a short period of time, it would seem, which is good. Do you prefer to do readings yourself at festivals? Do you dislike festivals intensely? Do you prefer to do online interviews like this? Or is it a case of, well, if I must, I must?
I enjoy doing festivals actually, and I don't mind doing readings. For Black History Month in February, I went to a senior cit what do you call it, a senior citizens group, and did a Black History presentation on the Daughter of Hades. Did a live reading to questions, and that was so much fun. I've never done anything like that before. I love that. And when I'm at festivals, I get to talk with readers and find out what they like, and yeah, and just discuss the art. So I really like the community there. I consider
Yeah.
myself an introvert, but usually these things just really get me excited.
Now, I can't recall because it was all the way back in January, but I can't recall, Mac, did we actually, or did Jessica, more importantly, put to you the key nutrition question about sweet tea back in January? Because it, she may have or she may not have. I just couldn't remember.
I can't remember either.
Well, in which case, Jessica, it's time, as we may have missed it, to actually ask Mac this on her debut to actually go down the sweet tea route. Bear in mind, I think Mac is now in Texas as opposed to yourself in North Carolina.
Okay, so you've probably got this one. So have you ever had some sweet tea or even maybe some boiled peanuts?
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah, that was a staple when I was growing up. I
Yes.
very sweet. And
It's funny.
there we are,
And
both nutritional types ticks there. So obviously that's the key thing, because it is Jessica's ambition to spread the word of sweet tea and boiled peanuts, of course, not necessarily together,
I mean,
across the globe.
you like.
it's because it's funny when I ask people, have you ever tried sweet tea? And especially people who are also from the US, and they're like, I don't know, I've never had that. And I'm like, oh, you're missing out. You have to try it. We need to get it global.
So, motoring on in terms of the whole system, what's the best way in which people can follow you, Mac, online through the socials? Have you switched on to X, formerly known as Twitter? Are you focusing on to the joys of Instagram? Are you on Facebook? What's the best way to actually stay in touch? Or do they just go to your website?
Facebook is a good way to stay in touch with me. I'm author Mac Little on Facebook and on Instagram and on X. I'm at Zen Baby, and that's Zen Baby. And yeah, you can go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, and that is Mac dot little dot no
Dot
mac
com, Mac hyphen little dot com will, I think, take you
mac
directly
at
there.
little dot com yes.
Excellent. Okay, well, again, as we head towards the second half of the year, of course, well into that, 2023 still zooming along, no pun intended. Any plans for another? I mean, Jessica's already kind of asked you this beforehand. Do you think there's going to be a third book before Christmas, or will we wait until January?
No, the third book won't come out until to late next year, I think.
Excellent.
Waiting on.
Well, upcoming a number of inspiring interviews about the progress that cancer research is actually making in particular. But Jessica, we've got two final questions. I'm sure Matt will remember them. Would you like to ask the first, please?
I would love to. Mac, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Yes.
You had to hesitate. There was a slight hesitation there. It was almost as though, oh, I don't know.
I was trying to it was the accent, I'm sorry. I was trying to translate
Awesome. It's like the Zoom. I always like end up breaking up on calls too, and you're like, somebody's attacking the Zoom line. I cannot understand.
Perhaps it's the guppies. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a
Yeah.
different line entirely. Anyway, allowing for that, can we look forward to featuring you again? Will you be kind enough to return in the not too distant future?
Absolutely, it would be my pleasure.
Well, in a world which increasingly seems to be full of negativity, it's nice to actually have some good news to report. And there has been a major milestone that's been reached in the fight against cancer, with over 1 million lives saved from the dreaded C word since the 1980s. And to talk us through some of the success of this, and of course, Cancer Research UK's excellent work in terms of this, we're delighted to welcome Senior Research Information Manager for Cancer Research UK, Dr. Claire Bromley. How are you, Claire?
Great. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you on board. And certainly, this is something which is good news. Would you like to just share with us some more details in terms of how maybe, just maybe, we are actually succeeding against what used to be seen very much as a death sentence of a disease?
Yes, of course. So it's absolutely fantastic, and I think really demonstrates the power of research that over 1 million lives, as you said, have been saved from cancer since the 1980s. And this is due to kind of research progress in both prevention, diagnosis, and treatments. A couple of examples are, for example, radiotherapy. Since the kind of 1920s and 30s, Cancer Research UK scientists really laid the foundation for that treatment and then have been improving its safety and effectiveness. And now today, millions of people worldwide every year benefit from radiotherapy. And radiotherapy, despite being seen as this kind of old-fashioned treatment, actually cures more people than cancer drugs. And we've also seen a really great increase in the number of kind of targeted and personalized cancer drugs available. Cancer Research UK scientists were involved in half of the world's essential cancer drugs. And I think things like tamoxifen and Herceptin are really like making progress and improving the lives of people with the disease.
And indeed, to coincide with the release of that new data that you referred to, Cancer Research UK's campaign, Together We Are Beating Cancer, is an attempt to link the charity's scientific breakthroughs with what it means for people with cancer and their families. And this is something, Claire, is about something which sometimes in the rarefied atmosphere of a research laboratory, maybe folk do forget how personal this can actually be, that the concern when you're actually given a diagnosis of cancer, even now, despite the fact that obviously there's a significant improvement in terms of survival rates, etc., can still be a very traumatic experience.
Yeah, exactly. And we know that despite these advances, cancer survival hasn't improved for everyone, not every type of cancer. And there are some types of cancer, such as brain tumors or pancreatic cancer, that is still incredibly hard to treat. And I think it's just absolutely important that we make that connection because, you know, more research means more moments for the people we love.
In terms of the social media hashtag More Moments campaign, have you got any to share yourself? I mean, are there any personal stories that you've had, Claire, in terms of folk that you've actually known who've endured this particular challenge?
Yeah, I think there's several ways. I think, you know, cancer has touched each and every one of us. My best friend's child currently is going through chemotherapy. They're just 1 year old and they've been diagnosed with childhood cancer. And also my grandma was affected by cancer. So, you know, cancer touches all of us. But what I think is absolutely just so exciting is the power of research to change lives and lead to, you know, longer, better lives free from the fear of cancer. And that's exactly what Cancer Research UK is here to do.
Now, we know that the National Health System is under terrific challenges and strains and stresses, etc., likewise, research, etc. And I see that Cancer Research UK are calling for strong political leadership, as well as an ambitious strategy for the NHS and cancer research in both camps. Do you think that that's a realistic objective? Do you feel optimistic that that's going to be secured? Or is it a case of, well, we've managed to make it this far, we're just going to give up the battle now?
No, I think, as you say, it's absolutely crucial we have that strong political leadership. We've recently had the government committing to, you know, that faster diagnosis standard and also the 9 cancer kind of wait time targets reduced to 3. This will hopefully give people with, you know, waiting for a diagnosis clearer expectations. But you say, like, this doesn't address the systemic challenges that face cancer treatment and care. And we know that there's this geographic variation across the UK where some patients are waiting much longer for a diagnosis. And this is just completely unacceptable. Everyone, wherever they live, should have access to timely diagnosis and high quality treatment. And that's why we'll continue to call on the government, continue to campaign and lobby the government to change this and make sure that everyone with cancer has, as I said, that timely diagnosis and high quality treatment.
Now, in addition to your excellent work, obviously, with Cancer Research UK, Claire, you've also worked as a postdoc at the Riken Center for Biodynamics Dynamics Research in Kobe, Japan. Now, clearly, did you have any indication there in terms of how Japan, for instance, is coping in the battle against cancer? I mean, is the UK kind of even Stevens ahead of the game, or is it just a case of, well, you can't really compare different countries?
I think it's quite hard to compare different countries, but I would say that the UK has, you know, historically been a leader in cancer research. But what we need to do is make sure that we're maintaining that. So things like Horizons Europe and getting that agreement. So, you know, cancer research in the UK is seen as an attractive place for new talented scientists to work is absolutely crucial.
And for folk who wish to find out further details about Cancer Research UK, is it as simple as just plugging it into your search engine and taking it from Mance?
Yeah, exactly. So our website is ciuk.org. So I'd suggest going there to find out any further information. And I would say to anyone listening today, if you have any concerns or have noticed anything unusual, please do contact your GP.
Dr. Claire Bromley, Senior Research Information Manager for Cancer Research UK. Many thanks indeed, and keep up the good work.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
coming along.
Ah, the return to school. It seems to get quicker each year, the time between June, July, and then into September. But how can we actually cope with that, especially when you see that parents are getting both excited and anxious about getting into a back-to-school routine? Well, we're delighted to welcome to talk to us about how Birdseye are also involved with this particular project, our media personality and mum of two and dance teacher. It's the awesome Caroline Thomas. How are you, Caroline?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, unfortunately, it's a parent who has to worry about children going to school. But then again, as somebody who actually is working in education, I've got one's own challenges to work through. But that's another line entirely. So let's talk a little bit about these particular findings. Parents feeling overwhelmed at the prospect of managing schedules, extracurricular activities. And of course, perhaps most importantly, how do you actually keep their children fed in a healthy and nutritious manner, no matter how busy things are actually getting? I mean, does this resonate with yourself, Caroline?
Absolutely. Every single word you've said, I can completely resonate with. It is a really, really tough time getting back to school. It comes around quicker every single year. But this year, I'm really glad to be partnering up with Birdseye with their new back to school campaign, which I really do think is going to help so many parents in this difficult time. It is, and Birdseye have done a little bit of research and found out that over half of parents stress about this time and worry about kind of their back to school in general, but it's also the food as well. Kind of coming back to school, there's so many things to worry about. And then amongst, you know, kind of doing the spellings, the homework, the reading, and then it's like making sure that the kids are getting the food, what they need. So Birdseye have got this amazing campaign just to kind of make people aware that the freezer is there to be on hand and to help you out.
I mean, this is really a critical side of the whole thing, because I was fascinated to see that in terms of average, most parents say, or at least one in three parents say, it takes their child 5 to 7 days before the start of term to get ready to go back to school. So clearly, by the time people are actually listening to this, they'll be there, they've gone through that whole process. And I'm intrigued by how, as I say, this back to school week of Birdseye handing out bundles of frozen products to families will actually help the stress challenges.
Do you know what? I think it's actually going to massively help. When I first heard about the campaign and then I did a little bit more research into it myself, I kind of put, you know, thought about it in my own shoes, and I thought, do you know what? This is actually really, really helpful. As in, it's just a reminder. And whilst they're going around the country, so they'll be going around the country, and it's an amazing old ice cream truck that's been wrapped in Birdseye. And they're going to be giving out the bundles of food, which will be like a main course, which will be like a chicken or a fish. And then you've got a veggie option, which will probably be the peas. And then there'll be like waffles. So it's just reminding people that it's there to help you. You don't have to be making a roast dinner every night. You don't have to be making, you know, a big, you know, amazing like spaghetti bolognese or anything. When there's so much else to be, you know, thought about, the food is there, the freezer is there to help you. And it is kind of compliant with government guidelines, with the salt, sugar and fats. It's all low in all of that. So you don't have to feel guilty about feeding your children out of the freezer, because Birdseye have got that covered for you.
I was going to ask Caroline, in terms of the nutritional value for the sort of things, we've heard a great deal over the last few years about the importance of making sure we have a balanced diet, etc. And clearly Birdseye have done the work for us on this one.
100%. And that's the best thing, that it is a trusted brand. I mean, it's been around since I was a child. I'm sure this the same with you. Knowing that it's been with us and kind of in British heritage for all this time, it just makes it a trusted brand. And I personally trust it. And after doing looking at the stats and everything, people should as well. Knowing that it's kind of there and it's there for you, and it has been for so long, we've just got to put our trust in Birdseye.
So what are your own children's favourite frozen foods then, Caroline?
So, my daughter is a bit controversial, I'm not going to lie. A couple of weeks ago, she said to me, can I have waffles? I was like, yes, of course. And I said, what would you like with them? Expect, you know, beans, jam, beans, sorry, eggs, something like that. And she says, Grandma lets me have jam. I was like, jam on waffles? She's like, yeah. So, okay. So I made this jam on bird's eye potato waffles and she loved it. And then I spoke to my mum later on in the afternoon. I went, Mum, where did the jam and the waffles come from? She went, I don't know what you're talking about. So Elsie had just made this up all by herself and blagged me that my mum had given her this jam and waffles and she just made it up all by herself. Yeah, but she absolutely loves it.
Children are so manipulative. That's the thing you have to be careful about, Caroline. That's a key thing.
I couldn't believe it. When I said to Adam as well, I went, yeah, my mum hadn't, because I was like, where's my mum got that from? I couldn't believe a kind of... like, where has she got that from? I never remember having that. So Elsie's made it up by herself, but she absolutely loves it. And that's a little sweet treat. So potato waffles now end up being breakfast and a little snack in the afternoon as well.
And do you have a personal favourite yourself? Are you a bird's eye pea person? Are you a fish finger gal?
I am a chicken dipper girl all the way. I absolutely love the chicken dippers. And I have done since being little. Like, I can remember coming home from school and my mum doing me chicken dippers and then I'll have like beans or whatever on the side and alpha bites, you know, like the little alphabet shapes. And she used to scramble it up until I could make a word out of it. I used to love doing that.
It just goes to show a whole range of educational activities for your food as well. Back to School UK tour is what we've been talking about. Where can people find out information about the Bird's Eye tour and indeed how close they're getting to their own region?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can have a look on the Bird's Eye website. There's a back to school section and it's going to be on their socials as well. So it's amazing. The van, me and Adam were lucky enough to go in it the other day. So if you want to... have a look and find out where it is and if it's coming to a town near you, then you can check it out and see. But if you are lucky enough to have it near you, I do recommend you go and see it and pick up some tasty treats.
There you go, Caroline Thomas, media personality extraordinaire and mum of two and dance teacher. Huge thanks and happy back to school time.
Thank you so much and good luck to all the parents listening as well. It is a tough time for us all.
Mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what the mama saw, it was against the law. The mama looked down and spit on the ground every time her name gets mentioned. Papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Mama, take me away, but the press let the story leak. Now when the radical preach come to get me released, we's all on the cover of Newsweek. And I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See you, me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
An idiot's eyes. I know I acted the fool. I know I fell on my ass. Ask me why I left you high and dry, only to wind up lonely. How could I be so cruel? I must have been to idiot school. If there was a stupid degree, I'd be a qualified klutz. You gave all your loving to me. I gave you a kick in the nuts so long. Long ago you loved me so, and I was your one and only. I threw away a jewel. I must have been to idiot school. We knew when I went away that one day you'd forget.
Idiot school.